Penguin Random House Audio presents In This Sign by Joanne Greenberg. Foreword by Sarah Novick. Afterword by the author. Read for you by Lisa Flanagan. Introduction. When it comes to deaf culture, I can be protective. The American deaf community is a diverse and vibrant subculture with our own rich history, language, and shared values. We are also small, tight-knit, and extremely marginalized by the larger hearing society around us, which can make us proprietary about our stories. At the heart of deaf culture is American Sign Language, ASL, a language different from English not only in its modality, but also in its vocabulary, grammar, syntax, and higher-level linguistic concepts. In part because of this language barrier, most hearing people can't or won't broach the divide between our worlds in a meaningful way in their lifetimes. As a result, deaf characters in fiction are a rarity, and when they do appear, they are often poorly rendered. Typically, deaf people in literature and film are pitiable, isolated, and innocent to the point of infantilization. These failures of the hearing imagination, the inability to comprehend that deaf people experience the full range of human emotions, have rich inner lives, and can be successful, are common on and off the page. Because of all this, we can be dismissive of hearing-made art about deaf culture. Theoretically, this isn't the best strategy, but then again, we've rarely been wrong. Across centuries of American literature, writers again and again confuse the physiological fact of deafness with the state of our intellect or our capacity for feeling. But being a non-speaking deaf person or one with heavily accented speech does not indicate that we are empty vessels in which to dump stereotypes or to use as symbols. We have much to say to those who will take the time to listen. Enter Joanne Greenberg. Born in Brooklyn, New York, in 1932, she is best known for her second novel, I Never Promised You a Rose Garden. Published in 1964, it is a semi-autobiographical account of a young woman's inpatient stay at a hospital while being treated for schizophrenia. Greenberg's portrayal of mental illness is decidedly unbeautiful, a departure from other cultural forces at the time, notably Sylvia Plath's The Bell Jar, published 1 year earlier. This was an explicit motivation, according to Greenberg, who said in an interview with the National Association for Rights Protection and Advocacy, NARPA, I wrote I Never Promised You a Rose Garden as a way of describing mental illness without the romanticization that it underwent in the 60s and 70s. During those days, people often confused creativity with insanity. There is no creativity in madness. Madness is the opposite of creativity. Although people may be creative in spite of being mentally ill. Greenberg is a writer who is clearly unafraid to approach complex topics from perspectives wholly her own, uninfluenced by trends of the zeitgeist. I can imagine that her lived experiences with mental illness have also made her familiar with the feeling of otherness in a society that so values normalcy. It makes sense, then, that Greenberg's interest was piqued by the deaf community, for whom her husband was working as a vocational rehabilitation counselor in the 1960s. In learning more about his clients and the systemic barriers they faced, Greenberg studied ASL and has since worked to establish deaf-accessible mental health programs at hospitals nationwide. Even knowing this, when I first cracked In the Sign, I was nervous about how an older book might portray deafness. Quickly, though, my worries were allayed. From its first pages, it's clear how effective Greenberg is at capturing the nuances of deaf culture. Originally published in 1970, the novel details the lives of deaf couple Abel and Janice Ryder, from their school days up through their eldest grandchild's college years, a timeline that spans from the 1920s to the 1960s. Abel's rural upbringing and attempted mainstream education result in language deprivation, an isolating syndrome that not only affects one's ability to communicate but also eventually causes cognitive damage. Most of Abel's childhood confusion and fear are crystallized in an upsetting sequence in which his mother shouts, "Ooh," at him repeatedly, then sends him into town alone, where he sits in a strange room all day. He does not realize until decades later, after learning ASL and having children of his own, that she must have been saying, "School." At the time of In the Signs publication, ASL had been recognized as a language for only about a decade. It was previously understood as gestures, or a bastardized version of English on the hands. As a result, American deaf education was only just beginning to wriggle out of the ironclad grip of the oralist ideology that had near unanimous rule since the late 19th century. Pure oralists believed that deaf people must be taught to speak and lip-read, and that sign language should be eradicated. Children caught waving hands were punished, their hands tied to desks, slammed in drawers, and struck with rulers. Eventually, Abel is freed from the confines of his isolation when he is sent to a school for the deaf as a teenager and begins to learn sign language. The school itself, though, is oral, as would have been typical of the 1920s, meaning the site of most deaf students' education was not inside the classroom at all. Every day for 2 hours, candles were blown out to make the letter P, and mouths moved to letters and pictures on the blackboard, and the students stared at tongues and teeth and lips. Dill, till, still, skill. But the words, the real words, were behind the outhouse, waiting, the language given and taken quickly at the fence. The forbidden signs made their users rich. Oralist programming prevented a lot of deaf children from reaching their academic potential. However, the gathering of deaf people together in campus spaces allowed the children themselves to pull one another up out of language deprivation to a degree. Abel began very slowly to wonder about words and thoughts themselves. Perhaps there were words for things not seen or touched. The more words Abel learned, the more things had meaning, the more memory. Simultaneously, Abel's new love for language bleeds into his admiration for a fellow student, Janice. Because Janice grew up boarding at the deaf school, she has always had sign, which is the thing that draws him to her. How busy she was, and how wise, with plans and ideas, with friends, angers, and the small wars of enemies. To Abel, hand-mute in the mind silence of his farm and hearing school, these plans and arguments were so wide a life that they seemed magic. Meanwhile, Janice, who is more educated than Abel but has rarely left the confines of the school, is enamored of the possibility of outside that he represents. Janice loved the idea of traveling. She loved all motion, all change, and Abel, who had spent his life in the world, who must have traveled easily from farm to town to city, seemed to her and the others a prince of promise. Like many young people, Janice and Abel are in love with the idea of each other and of the gaps in their own lives the other might fill. They quickly bond and plan to build a life together. While Abel delights in his new ability to make sense of the world around him through language, ultimately the school has left both him and Janice ill-prepared to navigate a hearing world designed to hide and eventually eradicate them. The idea behind the pure oralist movement, emphasis on pure, wasn't so much effective pedagogy as xenophobia. Its rise at the turn of the 20th century coincided with the burgeoning popularity of nativist and eugenics groups, which were concerned with how to forcibly assimilate the large number of immigrants arriving on America's shores, as well as the language and culture of deaf people, who seemed to them just as alien as foreigners. Deaf and disabled people who found themselves in federal custody were often subject to compulsory sterilization. As for the broader civilian populations of immigrants and deaf people alike, another solution was posited. Just speak English. Around this time, Scottish immigrant Alexander Graham Bell used his budding fame as an inventor to become an influential spokesperson for both nativism and eugenics. In one 1913 letter to a friend, he wrote, I believe that in an English-speaking...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?